Bobby through a hidden TV camera saw it all. Habits of your latest habits of your random friends and parents, and I bring you my heart, a nice guy. And you're full of this deception, it's your secret salad, but then when your bones are through and die. This little birdie told me who was talking to a fly.
And this is Terrible Tommy, Tom Esker. This is the Insurgent Radio Network, and this is Terrible Tommy, Tom Esker, here in the heartland, in the bunker, right here in north central Indiana, transmitting to the world.
Just watching on the monitor here reminded me of an old radio show I used to listen to when I was a kid, and they opened the show. This was long before television. They opened the show. He's walking into the drugstore. He's stepping on the scales. He's dropping in a coin. Weight, 270 pounds. Who is it? The Fat Man. It was a detective show. Your imagination be your guide, yeah. Terrible Tommy here, White Aryan Resistance Radio Network, right here at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. Don't forget our telephone number up there, our national telephone number that I should pay more attention to, 559-670-1473. I better change that because I haven't changed it for about 3 weeks. I'm telling you. Well, yeah, the reason I mentioned the Fat Man was simply because we're so lucky. Chris Christie has the governor of New Jersey. I think that's the state with more Jews than any other state in the Union in his clientele. And so Chris Christie's not going to go too far out of the way step outside the guidelines in New Jersey. But he wants to be the president now, and he just finished his big speech. I sort of watched the looks on the wife's face and his kid's face as he speaks, and to me it looked like they were getting awfully bored. Wouldn't you? He spoke for about an hour, I guess. Yeah. Well, I'm going to read to you from one of my favorite books. I've read from this book in the past, but it's been quite a while back. And it's called The Good Old Days, They Were Terrible. You know, the politicians like to gloss over how shitty it used to be, tell you how wonderful it used to be. Well, I think it was pretty good around here when I was a kid, even though my parents worked themselves to the bone in the local factory, dirty asbestos auto car lining factory, and chicken plant out here that killed the chickens and got them all set to send to the grocery and all that kind of stuff. They did all this crap work, and they didn't get paid very well, but they saved their nickels and dimes and bought this piece of property I live on back in 1949. They used to be out of the house at about 5:30 and be back at dark, and I was pretty much on my own during for many years there. So anyhow, it was pretty good here, but you get what I'm talking about. And if you lived in the city, it could be really bad. Remember about the turn of, before the turn of the last century, the big money men and the big banks were well installed. And they were screwing over the working people, no matter what color they were, for cheap labor, cheap wages, cheap everything, while the rich people, you've seen some of their big mansions that they used to live in and all that kind of stuff. But you don't hear that much from these politicians. They talk like, oh, it was very nice, you know. And then the Negro question, they were too cheap to ship them back to Africa, but they weren't too cheap to keep them and make wage slaves out of them, competing with the white worker. So anyhow, that's a little bit of a beginning to what I'm going to read to you. Now we're going to talk about education here. Now it was always the desire of the super rich in the old days to keep people pretty stupid, whether they were white or not. And good education was only had by the children of the wealthy. So the white working class had to fight for every little bit it could get as far as education and everything else. Criticism of the public school system, America's most jealously treasured institution, usually takes the form of nostalgia for its golden age, the days of the little red schoolhouse. Here, it is believed, was the wellspring of the nation's greatness, where the three R's were taught in an atmosphere of patriotism and simple virtue, where individualism was sanctified, the warts of alien culture were ground away, and finally the American character was shaped. In a time of widespread educational hysteria, it is a vision hard to resist. However, it is not an accurate one. The little schoolhouse was the dispensary of only limited information, much of it questionable, that was force-fed to pupils. Thinking was discouraged in favor of memorizing prepackaged noble thoughts, and the three R's were imparted with painful repetition associated more with training a dog. Good spelling was a major goal, more even than the word meaning, and the classroom resounded like a parade ground to the monotonous cadence of vowels and consonants, the spelling bee, an American phenomenon that confuses the rapid emission of facts with true knowledge, survives in our quiz programs. Recalling his own school days during the 1880s, Alvin Johnson, the great educator, said, quote, "We expected to learn nothing in school, and we were not disappointed," unquote. But we were good for cannon fodder in the wars, and we were good for cheap labor in the foundries. A man who had failed at everything bought himself a birch rod and became a teacher. Rural schools were handicapped not only by size, one room for all ages. In fact, I attended a grade school that there were two classes, two different ages in one room. But by the quality of instruction they dispensed, teaching was an occupation of minimal prestige with low pay, low standards, and a high turnover rate. It was said that anybody could be a teacher, and while no doubt some were fine, dedicated individuals, most proved shiftless and unimaginative, products of the very system they perpetuate. And it's the same today. Can you imagine if you're a white kid in Chicago, in these schools taught by these black teachers? Big, fat, blimp, black teachers that can barely talk or speak the English themselves. Because children supplied essentially farm labor, the school year lasted barely 12 weeks. From Thanksgiving through early spring, it was hardly enough time for learning or to encourage a teacher who genuinely sought results. And the salaries in 1888 and 89, an average of $42.43 a month for men and $38.14 for women, grudgingly relinquished from frugal budgets. You know, the town leaders just didn't want to spend that much on education. Attracted mostly young men in transit to a profession or women who declared themselves school marms to get away from a suffocating home life. Sometimes the teacher was a girl younger than several of her pupils and almost as ignorant. Teachers were compensated for their low pay by being allowed to alternate free board and lodging with various families. But many could not endure the accompanying scrutiny given their private lives and quit in disgust after a term or two, leaving the curriculum in chaos. Clarence Darrow recalls, quote, "We seldom had the same teacher for two terms of school, and we always wondered whether the new one would be worse or better than the old one." Corporal punishment. Licking and larning goes together with licking no larning. The foregoing dogma was the basic of the educational philosophy of the old days. Lessons were regarded as a commodity to be pressed into the reluctant vessels, the humans, and a birch rod or hickory stick was used to accomplish this end. Legally, in loco parentis, teachers relied upon it more heavily to enforce discipline. Their devotion to scholarship often measured by the number of backsides they had reddened. Humanitarians, a tiny minority, thought otherwise, among them a former schoolmaster named Walt Whitman, who complained of the military discipline of the schools. Quote, "The flogging plan is the most wretched item yet of school keeping," he thundered. "What nobleness can reside in a man who catches boys by the collar and cuffs their ears?" But such criticism posed no threat to corporal punishment, which was extensively hailed as a healthy and indispensable practice. One inveterate disciplinarian referred to his weapon as my Board of Education, unquote. And the commitment with this belief went on and Astur mistrust of the improvements to the physical plant because they were a luxury. A Washington Territory schoolmarm's plea for the installation of toilets was turned down by the school board, which advised her that there were plenty of trees in the yard to get behind. Even her suggestion to replace the single well dipper with one more hygienic individual cups was denied as being undemocratic. See, all through this, it's an economic war, it's a class war. People with the money, once I got the money, they did not want to spend it on any public education at all if they could get away with it. And they didn't want to spend it on better wages at all if they could get away with it. Discipline. The indisputable reality of classroom disorder presented a valid case against appeals for an end to birching. The Little Red Schoolhouse was not a stable of docile lambs. Many of the children were downright brats, hostile, unforgivable, and prone to violence. In addition, the assembly in one room of pupils ranging in age from 5 to 16, with some strays even in their 20s, was an invitation to trouble. Under these circumstances, the teacher was more warder than instructor, his routine more physical than intellectual. Some school boards, in selecting a new teacher, made it a rule to pick a strong fellow, especially on the frontier, where, according to Hamlin Garland, quote, baseness and vulgarity prevailed among the older boys. Biting, eye gouging, and slug and scuffle matches were favorite sports, but boys saved their most barbaric excesses for strangers. Quote, let a boy from one town visit another, and he was fortunate if he escaped with his life. The intervillage feuds made it incumbent upon the boys of one town to stone, beat, thrash such a casual visitor, unquote. Faced with such ruffians, many teachers did not last a week, some not even a day. In the Flat Creek District, says Edward Eggleston, the boys have driven off the last two schoolmasters and licked the one afore them. Villagers and their school boards took macabre delight in the encounter between a new teacher and the boys, some of whom were 175-pound six-footers. For schoolmarms, such confrontations were an ordeal even in the East, describing her first day at a New York, England District School, Mary Ellen Chase recalls, quote, I stormed up and down, this pathetic pretense of courage, aided by the mad flourishing of my razor strap, brought forth the expression of respectable fear on the faces of these young giants. However, while Miss Chase's pantomime succeeded in cowing heavyweights who were old enough to go to sea, other schoolmistresses encountered continual discipline problems. One of these, a Miss Barstow, taught public school in Canton, Massachusetts. Incidentally, Canton, Massachusetts had an all-black school up there that was burned down in 1888 by white people. On October 8, 1870, this young girl, said to be in feeble health, punished four boys for unruly conduct by shutting them in the school building after class was out. Finally, when she released them, Miss Barstow is said to have given the boys a slight reprimand. Their response was immediate. They stoned her to death. History is interesting, isn't it? Okay. Now we'll go to Negro education. Now remember, if the very rich and the upper classes would have said, well, now that they're free, we've got no reason to keep them around. Let's ship them back to Africa. Just think how wonderful it would be today. But no, they said, we'll take them into the north, and we'll take them around, and we'll use them to keep the white man's wages down. And we'll keep them segregated so that they can't allegedly do any harm, which that's ridiculous. They did. Of the 4 million slaves freed after the Civil War, only 1 in 10 could read and write. Throughout the first half of the century, slaveholders had been assiduously keeping them ignorant. Knowledge, they feared, would breed insurrection. Some states made teaching a black child a crime, and the governor, James Kimball Verdamme of Mississippi, a wild negrophobe, declared that any money spent on the black education was a robbery of the white man. But yet they couldn't see themselves clear to load them up and ship them back out to Africa. The shame and hypocrisy of these sanctions were condemned by northern abolitionists, liberals, who diagnosed the black man's trouble. We deliberately withheld from him the humanizing and softening influences of education, and then we reproach him that he is not thrifty, not enlightened, not virtuous. Well, they wanted to treat him as equals. They always did want to treat him as equals, and of course that's impossible. But these northern abolitionists didn't push very hard for any kind of return to Africa either. They wanted to cozy up to them and be nice to them and treat them as equal. Some of those abolitionists even promoted interracial marriage. Doing our best to make him a bad citizen, we reproach him for not being a good one. But their high hopes following the Civil War of providing the freedmen's children with an elementary education went largely unfulfilled. State constitutions amended to give blacks separate but equal education were blithely ignored. Promised budgetary funds were simply never paid, and the school facilities remained totally unequal. You realize how much this cost white society and the separate but equal, all that crap, instead of loading them up on the ships and sending them back? W.E.B. Du Bois, the educator, has left an account of the black school. He was also a member of the Communist Party. A log hut where Colonel Wheeler used to shelter his corn. Chinks between the logs served as windows. My chair borrowed from the landlady had to be returned every night. There were no desks, and crude, backless planks served as seats, which had the one virtue of making napping dangerous. City schools. Our public schools are going to the dogs. Well, they're still going to the dogs. In 1890, only 20% of all the Negro children received any education at all, and their lifetime schooling averaged 100 days. Well, it wasn't too much different for the white poor kids. In reviewing the pitiful conditions of the early black schools, there is a temptation to assume the opposite about white public schools, but such assumptions would not be entirely accurate. City schools were badly neglected as political bosses and the very rich ransacked education funds. And they did this with impunity, since the Board of Education was appointed by aldermen who were appointed by the mayor, who was controlled by the bosses and those on up. In this game of spending less public money on education and more on themselves, Boss Tweed of the New York was, of course, the champion. Not only did he mulch funds assessed for new school buildings, but he connived to have all city school books scrapped in order to provide a profit from the sale of the new books produced by Tweed-controlled printing plants. Nor was his handicap to education limited to New York City. St. Louis, Philadelphia, and Chicago, among others, had their own educational Tweed days. Consequently, city schools were overcrowded and underventilated, compounding the difficulty of teaching youngsters of various ethnic and racial backgrounds. Many teachers confessed that the best they could do was to maintain order, and that's pretty much what they do today, especially in the so-called inner city schools. Now, you know that Chicago Jewish mayor has closed about, 100 or so schools in Chicago, at least. Closed them. Now, where are these kids go? These black kids, where are they going? They're going into the gangs and into the street. New York Commissioner of Education frankly admitted in 1871 that thousands of children leave school without being able to read or write. And that's happening again, especially in the inner city. In New York, children are forced to attend schools which is in foulness could put to shame a garbage pit. The American compulsion to spend unlimited funds on ultra-modern school buildings may contain a hint of delusion, but it can be appreciated more readily when examined against the schools of the past. To begin with, there were not sufficient buildings, and those that did exist were poorly constructed and maintained, filthy, and invariably overcrowded, the last being the most dangerous of their evils. Schools built for 1,000 pupils had twice that number jammed into their classrooms. A survey of the Brooklyn schools in 1893 listed 18 classes with 90 to 100 students. One class had 158. Desks were insufficient and badly made. Often three children shared a desk built for two. A visitor to Cincinnati in the same year found one schoolroom where the furniture was so closely packed that the children were literally obliged to squeeze their little bodies in between the desks, scarcely room enough to expand their lungs, much less move their limbs about freely. To one observer, the city school where the children's chests were sunken, their shoulders rounded, was a factory of hunchbacks. And a New York slum school perched over a live chicken market, lacking chairs and benches, had its students study on their knees. New York City schools were encumbered by their location, which precluded access to adequate lighting or ventilation. Crammed into narrow streets and overshadowed by tall buildings or an adjacent elevated railroad, these schoolrooms frequently were lighted by only a single jet whose flickering spread an atmosphere of melancholy and gloom. Its yellow flame blazed in the teacher's eye, leaving the scholars insufficient light to read their books. Air quality proved as efficient as lighting. A Massachusetts law requiring 1,800 cubic feet of fresh air per hour per student. In New York, students got closer to 70 cubic feet. The air became so vitiated, foul, and unhealthy that the teachers were compelled to suspend the studies. Well, let's see here. Let's take a little pause. A risk of infectious disease was present in the classrooms in the absence of bodily cleanliness, parasites. Particularly among immigrant children who descended on the schools like a great army of unwashed. Quote, the teachers found themselves giving hundreds of baths each week, and one small student answered his teacher's criticism of his appearance with, quote, don't never wash, catch cold. One of the most serious handicaps to systematic instruction, at least in New York City, was noise. Quote, I have seen one teacher made voiceless, and many made hoarse by the constant shouting necessitated by sounds from adjoining buildings and the maddening bang and crash of hammers. These external noises included the omnipresent racket of L, were supplemented by the self-generating din and babble of the classrooms. Now, this is what we're going to go back to, or similar times if we have an economic crash and the bulk of society sinks back into being peasants again, which they're starting to do. All it takes is another really severe dollar crash. Each child is treated as if he possesses no individuality and no soul, unquote. Dr. J.M. Rice, a pediatrician turned educator, found little difference among primary schools in 36 cities. Education had been devalued to a factory-style routine in which the pupils were regarded as exactly similar and therefore could be drilled with mechanical efficiency. In other words, they were teaching a form of equality back then just to save money. In a St. Louis school, he reported children lined up stiffly, silent and motionless during recitation, their toes aligned over the edge of the floorboard. All spontaneity had been suppressed in favor of a queer obsession with symmetry. Quote, "How can you learn anything with your knees and toes out of order?" a teacher demanded. Darrow recalled that beyond "yes, ma'am" or "no, ma'am," children were prohibited from speaking. It was assumed that what we had to say was of no account. Just remember, the ruling class decide what's in the books that your kid studies. It's always been that way. They decide who your heroes are, who your kid's heroes are going to be, and so forth. So I hope you realize that. Rice noticed a very literal interpretation of this advice in the New York City classrooms where students were prohibited from even moving their heads. Quote, "Why should they look behind when the teacher's in front of them?" Unquote. He was asked. The humorless, bloodless approach to teaching so typical of the period is captured in his description of a Chicago pedagogue who never smiled or offered the slightest encouragement. She sat in a chair, as sober as a judge trying a criminal case. Most of her students, while speaking, were trembling from head to foot, unquote. Naturally, neither truancy nor dropping out was discouraged by such a system, although by the 1870s, compulsory education was the law in most states. Poorer families, particularly immigrants, preferred to have their children at work than in school. Often the pay scale made it a matter of survival. In the New York blighted Five Points area, only 9 children out of the 600 attended school in 1870. For the poor who did attend school, there was an added handicap to the stultifying methods of instruction, hunger. Now remember, a lot of you people out there, your ancestors were coming into the country about that time, the latter part of the 19th century. Figures for New York, Philadelphia, Buffalo, and Chicago in 1905 showed that of the 40,746 school children, 34% left home either without breakfast or having had a totally inadequate one of unwholesome bread and tea. Well, that's probably more healthy than what most kids get today. They're eating tons of sugar and crap that's a lot worse than bread and tea. No wonder these students were listless and despair of the teachers who realized that you cannot educate a hungry child. Well, you cannot educate an over-sugarized child either, or some of them given these drugs to calm them down and all that kind of stuff. I had experience with that at one time. When I was in the Klan, one of the guys went to jail, and I took his 2 boys for a while, a month or so, and took care of them. And when they came to me, they were bouncing off the ceiling from being over-sugarized. Don't forget to read that book, Sugar Blues, if you don't believe what I'm saying. You got to get off that sugar. Anyhow, we put them on a sugarless diet, or a very limited sugar, my wife and I, and in 2 or 3 weeks, they were as calm as you could be. No problem at all. So we know that that's the type of thing that works. Diet is extremely important. In 1904, Dr. W.H. Maxwell, the head of the Board of Education of New York, said that the number of U.S. school children unable to learn as a result of hunger was in the hundreds of thousands. Well, that's the way you keep society dumb and subservient. and ready to put on a uniform and go to war for at the drop of the hat to protect the super rich. Yes, that sounds leftist, doesn't it? You're goddamn right it does, and it's the truth. The alternative for some poor children was to work during the day and attend night school, where it was felt they could prepare better for work in a factory. In any event, the working class regarded elementary education as impractical because it offered subjects that had no application to the new industrial order. I mean, what good did it learn what little they did learn if they had no kind of a job that they could use the education on, except just plain brute force labor, digging ditches and so forth. Or working in a industrial mill, stamping out crap. Teachers subsist on a pittance. They must pinch and save until life is not worth living. I remember that as a kid. Most of my teachers were poor as hell. And very few of them got credit for what they did. The grade school was born of necessity in the 1870s. The one-room building had become totally inadequate for city populations. Now, my stepfather, who was a lot older than my mother, he left school in the 8th grade from a one-room schoolhouse. And whatever he learned outside the school. He was pretty smart, though. And the idea of separate and progressive grades was intelligent and practical. It would have been an ideal system if the teaching had been adequate, but it wasn't. Well, I may have lost my place again here, but here we go. Before 1900, teaching was not a bona fide profession. Teachers' institutes gave informal lectures, graduating anyone who served a brief apprenticeship and a regular normal schools, which had a slightly higher standing. Only 20% of the students in 1890 had high school diplomas. Chicago's requirements were similarly casual. No diploma was required, and any young man or woman could become a teacher if they accompanied an incumbent on his rounds as part of the cadet program. But even teachers of natural ability became quickly demoralized by the low pay, lack of promotion, and graft-ridden appointment system, and their performance reflected it. Their salaries, subject to the whims of the school board, often went down when the budget was cut. Favoritism, too, was general, and a teacher with good connections could get double the salary of a colleague who had none. Women teachers suffered greatly as a result of the chafing sex discrimination of the period. For the same work, they got less than half of a male teacher's salary. Well, it's been that way even up to modern times. After 5 years' service in the New York City schools, they could expect a raise of $40 a year. That's it. That is, if they had not married or engaged in other unseemly conduct, unquote, which invariably meant dismissal. Despite the poor wages, teaching jobs belonged to the patronage concessions held by politicians during the Tweed era, who served the ruling class, a time of extensive pioneering in governmental corruption. Jobs were actually auctioned. Merit, of course, counted for nothing. Philadelphia school boards were considered even more corrupt than New York's, having, as they did, enormous shakedown charges. It cost you $120 to buy a teaching job, $175 for a transfer between schools. The word education means to draw out, and that's what I say. If it's not there, you're not going to draw it out. That's why they think they're going to... Even among white people, you have that problem. But Negroes, are you kidding? You can't draw it out if it's not there. You can't open up their skull and pour it in. The word education means to draw out, to develop the sentiment and intellectual qualities that are already there, inborn. And that has to do with race. But what's passed for education in the early 1890s, as the elementary grade school became fully developed, had only a remote connection to the original concept. making grades was the only goal. Well, that was the way it was when I was a kid, too. An excessively heavy curriculum meant endless cramming for students without any time left to contemplate what it was they were learning. A young girl of the 1880s described her anxiety after a day's drilling, her whole time having been taken up with reviews while she trembled every minute for fear I shall forget some date of history or rule in algebra. When I finally sit down to dinner, my head feels fit to burst. You got to understand that a large percentage of what you learn in school you never use again. That's why there should be trade schools, and then schools for higher science, but not a general education. Often poorly educating themselves, the teachers stuck rigidly to the manual prescribed by the board. Many were interested in neither the pupils nor their jobs, and took it the easy way out, becoming little more than drill masters and recitation hearers. And that's it. That's the end of our study of the educational system of those years, 19th century and good part of the 20th century, actually. But we got to understand we're headed back that way based upon dollar collapse. And I'm telling you, I don't like to do like Alex and all these guys scare people, but if you look carefully at the financial situation at the moment, both in Europe and the United States, a very bad crash could happen at any moment. And when it does, can you imagine the runs on the bank here in the United States and stuff? And how the dollar value will take a dump? I suggest you every home be stocked with a good share of books, educational material, CDs, DVDs, tapes, wherever you can get it, so that if you need to be, you can give your children some education, even if everything's collapsed, and find out your best sources of food from your farmers. Truck patch, as we call them. Used to call them truck patch dealers. We're lucky here in Indiana. We got a lot of them, and I think Wednesday and Saturday, they're all over the place. But I know the government lives on fear, but you need to be fearful about a lot of things. but usually the wrong things. The fearing that there's a terrorist lurking behind every tree is a simple way of keeping you obedient, and that they're going to get us, and so you better join up so we can go get them first. All that is the wrong kind of fear. You may have some fear that some jerk is going to try to break into your house, but you can usually guard yourself against that by simple tactics. But anyhow, you need to circle the wagons and keep them circled, and we'll go from there, I'll tell you. Well, get ready for another big clusterfuck. The KKK plans a South Carolina Statehouse rally coming up on the 29th? I forget for sure, but anyhow, the Ku Klux Klan will hold a rally at the South Carolina Statehouse next month to protest efforts to remove the Confederate flag from the Capitol grounds. And I heard on black radio they're getting all their people all excited about showing up and confronting the Klan. So stay tuned for a real Donnybrook, which will prove nothing.
Now to a disturbing story in Whittier. Many residents there woke up to racist flyers in their driveways and lawns. Police are now investigating the incident after similar flyers were distributed in Orange County last week. Eyewitness News reporter Adrian Bankert has reaction.
This is crazy.
This is terrible.
Neighbors on Adele Avenue in Whittier woke up to this. White supremacist literature from the KKK on their lawns and doorsteps.
we don't appreciate that kind of stuff around here, and I know my neighbors feel the same exact way as I do.
They don't want us to feel safe in our own community, to make you feel like, okay, maybe I need to move out of here or something, like trying to bully us in a way.
The flyers contained hateful language, derogatory speech about certain ethnic groups, the president, and a particular presidential candidate. There was a piece of candy in each bag thrown on almost every lawn over several blocks.
I was sleeping on the couch, and I kind of looked out, and I saw a white van going by about 2:30, and I thought it was the newspaper man being delivered on Sunday, but maybe it wasn't because the newspaper wasn't delivered in front of the house.
I'm shocked, yeah. I'm surprised someone would come out and do that over here or anywhere.
While there is still a chance someone in the neighborhood captured surveillance video by home security camera, whoever did this wasn't breaking the law.
Their goal was to cause an uproar or really didn't do that.
I still feel safe in my neighborhood.
While police here in Whittier have yet to comment, neighbors say that this is just yet one more reason to come together in this tight-knit and diverse community. In Whittier, Adrian Bankert, ABC 7 Eyewitness News.
A disturbing discovery Sunday morning for residents near Adele and Orange Avenues in Whittier. Dozens of bags filled with rocks, candy, and Ku Klux Klan propaganda were left in front of homes. The propaganda includes the message, "Wake up, white America," on one side, on the other, "Like father, like son," aimed at Republican presidential candidate Jeb Bush.
We don't need this around here. There's no reason for this.
Tracy Waddell and his wife called police after they discovered the packets while grabbing their newspaper.
This has gone on too long. We don't need this in our society anymore. People need to grow up.
The flyers included a North Carolina phone number for the Loyal White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. They also indicated they were from a California chapter of the notorious white supremacist organization. The Loyal White Knights left the same type of recruitment bags in front of homes in Santa Ana in January and in Orange last July.
I've never seen anything like this around here, and I wouldn't want them coming around here at all.
Even though the bags don't identify a specific threat, these Whittier residents are angry and outraged they're the latest recipients of the racist propaganda.
It makes me want to find out who it is, if they're playing a sick joke, why would they do this?
And now, because there is no specific threat, Whittier police say there's no criminal investigation. Live in Whittier, Kirk Hawkins, KTLA 5.
Well, I played some of that for you because some of these Hollywood... Wait a minute. Some of these Hollywood clans are out there throwing their stuff around again. Now, when is a Klan going to learn that this doesn't change anything? In fact, it makes it worse. I say wait till the conditions go shitty and the marauding crime gangs invade these neighborhoods and kick the shit out of these people. Let the crime overwhelm them. They don't like white information and so forth. They don't like white racism. Well, let them see what the opposite is. That's the only way they'll learn. But put this stuff out thinking you're going to recruit everybody into the Klan is totally insane. And sometimes at this point, after all these decades, I wonder how many FBI informants are involved in these Klan groups that are doing that, just to keep people's mind off the real problems. Isn't it interesting how the KKK and some of these Hollywood Nazis can get all this publicity? Now, I used to play that game back in the old days, but I began to figure it out. They didn't want you on TV speaking clearly and intelligently about what the real big problems are in the country and the world. They just wanted to talk about the KKK and burning crosses and all that kind of stuff. So all you have to do is throw some papers around now and you can get press all over the world. But are any spokesmen for the racial position invited on television shows? Are they really seriously interviewed for newspapers and so forth? No, because the press have it absolutely sealed tight that no kind of positive speech about race is possible. But they'll put out all you want about Hollywood Nazis and Hollywood KKK. Yeah, you can get press every day of the week doing that. Now remember, if it bleeds, it leads, and there's nothing the press could be happier about if this rally turns into a blood fest. If blacks and whites pull out guns and start blowing each other away, that'd be the greatest news that they could get, because they'll say, no, we don't believe in that. We don't want violence. The press loves violence. They live on violence. They can't get enough violence. Well, I see the usual suspects are back at it now that they can get some press, and that is out of Branson, Missouri. That's Tom Slob, as we used to call him. Tom Slob ran a Hollywood Klan. He still runs a Hollywood Klan down there in Missouri. In an interview with the News Leader on Monday, she said, and this was Anna Robb, his daughter, "The flag represents faith, family, and freedom, not slavery, racism, or white supremacy." No, that's the battle flag there, ma'am, Anna. It represents the troops that fought in the war, and I would like to see it represent all the troops that fought and died in the war, north and south. But at least the battle flag is just to commemorate those that died and needlessly, the white working class, in the war. The Stars and Stripes, however, Stars and Stripes, now there's a real racist flag. It's flown over every plantation that you can imagine, all over the South and the British Empire. Union Jack, too. I guess if you want to bring down racist flags, that's a good place to start. On Thursday, the News Leader was alerted by the readers of Rob's husband's Nathan, co-owner of the store, once tried to adopt a highway in Arkansas on behalf of the Ku Klux Klan's, so that Tom Robb could go out with his people and pick up the garbage along, nigger garbage along the highway, which would bring the Klan a lot of respect. All the used condoms and beer cans that the niggers throw out on the highway, the Klan couldn't wait to say, "We want to clean it up. Let us clean it up. We'll get a lawyer and make you let us clean it up." Well, the Taney County Assessor's records show that Anna and Nathan Robb own Dixie Outfitters in Branson, a franchise store, get that, that sells Confederate flag merchandise, located at 1819 West State Highway 670. See how they give them free advertising and everything? On Monday, Anna Robb spoke to the News Leader about what she felt was wrong, the wrong impression many people have about the Confederate flag. Confederate battle flag, Anna. Quote, "It has nothing to do with slavery. Are you kidding?" What were all those plantations down south? Didn't that have something to do with slavery? And didn't they fly a Confederate flag over them? Why do people sidestep the issue and just admit it? Yeah, I'm a racist. Yeah, the flag is racist. I love the flag. It's racist. And I'm going to keep flying it because I'm a racist. Why all this? Well, I'm not a racist. Well, then why are you flying the flag? Well, it's a cultural thing. Anna Robb was asked her thoughts by the News Leader as national debate grew over the meaning of the Confederate flag. The controversy emerged earlier this month after the world learned about the strident racism of 21-year-old Dylan Roof, who was charged with gunning down 9 people and reloading 5 times while evidently none of the niggers tried to stop him. I don't know. Strange if that's true. Anna Robb said she and her husband have not spoken to Thomas Robb in years. Well, I thought he was the head of their clan. She denied that she or her husband were ever part of the KKK, but did say she had attended KKK events in the past. Quote, "I have years ago," she said. "That was years ago, and that is not even something that comes up anymore," unquote. "It has nothing to do with me, the store is this issue at hand," Anna Robb said. I didn't know that Anna has split from Thomas Robb, the man who said that Robert Matthews was a common criminal and deserved what he got. Oh, you didn't know that? Well, I've told you before. According to the several news articles from 1991, when Nathan Robb was 20, he requested to adopt 1 mile of U.S. 65 highway at the Arkansas-Missouri state line so he could clean up nigger garbage. According to an Associated Press from 1992, Nathan Robb was then the den commander of a Klan group in Harrison, Arkansas. His request to participate in the anti-litter program was turned down. I mean, even the white fathers of the county didn't want to see a white man humiliate himself by picking up nigger garbage. Nigger condoms, used condoms and stuff. When asked about Nathan Robb's application on behalf of the KKK to take part in the Arkansas Adopt a Filthy Highway program in the 1990s, Anna Robb said that was when he was very young. He'd not like that anymore. Oh, okay, Anna. Anna Robb said business at Dixie Outfitters, which specializes in Confederate flag clothing and memorabilia, is absolutely up this week. Well, you can't keep a capitalist down. We're working around the clock, she said. People from across the country are excited about our store. They're flooding our website. I had to bring in extra staff just to fill the orders. Anna Robb said in a one-hour Tuesday, more than 300 orders came in for Confederate flags. This time last week, she estimates they were getting about a dozen orders a day. Whoa, big business. Big business now. Walmart, along with Sears, Amazon, and eBay, announced bans on the Confederate flag products amid the growing nationwide debate over the symbol. Well, why not the stars and stripes? It's far more racist. And Valley Forge Flag, one of the biggest flag makers in the U.S., announced it will stop manufacturing and selling Confederate flags. Well, the Robs can get involved in manufacturing flags now. You can make a fortune. Nathan Robb was not available for comment. Anna Robb said because he was trying to keep up with the orders and the merchandise in their warehouse. Yeah. Okay, well, that's the way it goes. Good luck there with getting rid of all your stock in the back room closet there. Better sell them while you can. It won't last very long. These kind of things, they spur up, people get all excited, and then in a week or so they die down. So don't put too much money into buying product there, Anna. Tell your rotten old dad too that I'll never let him forget what he said about Robert Matthews, and he's lucky he's still walking around. Well, that's it for today, boys and girls. We'll be back tomorrow on Wotan's Day. That's right, David Lane's favorite day. In the meantime, remember, there is no such thing as equality, and there's no such thing as a right. You have a privilege granted to you by the ruling class until you disobey or step out of your set position in life, and then you'll find your right is gone immediately. Because they have a right to put a military boot through your door. That's when your right ends. Your privilege ends. And if you're waiting on the baby Jesus to save you, well, I don't know what to tell you. You've been waiting on him for over 2,000 years. He's out to lunch, baby.
You know, it would be great for a guy like me just to be in a coma. Would that be great? Boy, you know, you just crap out, nothing to do all day. You breathe through a fucking tube, they feed you through a tube, and nothing to do. That's really living, you know what I mean? No phone calls coming in, nobody dropping by unexpectedly. And if they do drop by, you're completely unaware of it. Because you're in a fucking coma, and you're practically clinically dead. And you don't have to listen to their stupid bullshit. Their stupid bullshit. Like about their new ride-around lawnmower with the two-tone horn and the GPS in case they get lost on the lawn. and their boss and their job and their car.
This is Walter Dennis. I'd like to ask you something.
Well, Walter Dennis, it wasn't your turn. You gotta wait your turn. Maybe later in a week, Walter. Get back in the closet. I will say you're about due, though.
Clouds that we're